500 Spaniards and 100 black slaves founded a town perhaps near the mouth of the P.D. River in present-day South Carolina. Disease and disputes with nearby Indians caused many deaths in the early months of the settlement. In November, the slaves rebelled, killed some of their masters, and escaped to the Indians. By then, only 150 Spaniards survived. They retreated to Haiti. The ex-slaves remained behind and probably merged with nearby Indian nations. This is cocktail party trivia, I suppose. American history textbooks cannot be faulted for not mentioning that the first non-native settlers in the United States were black. Educationally, however, the incident has its uses. It shows that Africans, is it too early to call them African Americans, rebelled against slavery from the first. It points to the important subject of three-way race relations, Indian, African, European, which most textbooks completely omit. It teaches that slavery cannot readily survive without secure borders. And symbolically, it illustrates that African Americans and the attendant subject of black-white race relations were part of American history from the first European attempts to settle. Perhaps the most pervasive theme in our history is the domination of black America by white America. Race is the sharpest and deepest division in American life. Issues of black-white relations propelled the Whig Party to collapse, prompted the formation of the Republican Party, and caused the Democratic Party to label itself the White Man's Party for almost a century. The second time Congress overrode a presidential veto was for the 1866 Civil Rights Act, passed by Republicans over the wishes of Andrew Johnson. Senators mounted the longest filibuster in U.S. history, more than 534 hours, to oppose the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. Thomas Byrne Edsel has shown how race prompted the sweeping political realignment of 1964 through 1972, in which the White South went from a Democratic bastion to a Republican stronghold. Race still affects politics, as evidenced by the notorious Willie Horton commercial used by George Bush in the 1988 presidential campaign, and the more recent candidacies of the Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke. Race riots continue to shake urban centers from Miami to Los Angeles. Almost no genre of our popular culture goes untouched by race. From the 1850s through the 1930s, except during the Civil War and Reconstruction, minstrel shows, which derived in a perverse way from plantation slavery, were the dominant form of popular entertainment in America. During most of that period, Uncle Tom's Cabin was our longest-running play, mounted in thousands of productions. America's first epic motion picture, Birth of a Nation, first talkie, The Jazz Singer, and biggest blockbuster novel ever, Gone with the Wind, were substantially about race relations. The most popular radio show of all time was Amos and Andy, two white men posing as humorously incompetent African Americans. The most popular television miniseries ever was Roots, which changed our culture by setting off an explosion of interest in genealogy and ethnic background. In music, race relations provide the underlying thematic material for many of our spirituals, blues numbers, reggae songs, and rap pieces. The struggle over racial slavery may be the predominant theme in American history. Until the end of the 19th century, cotton, planted, cultivated, harvested, and ginned by slaves, was by far our most important export. Our graceful antebellum homes, in the North as well as the South, were built largely by slaves, or from profits derived from the slave and cotton trades. Black-white relations became the central issue in the Civil War, which killed almost as many Americans as died in all our other wars combined. Black-white relations was the principal focus of Reconstruction after the Civil War. America's failure to allow African Americans equal rights led eventually to the struggle for civil rights a century later. The subject also pops up where we least expect it. At the Alamo, throughout the Seminole Wars, even in the expulsion of the Mormons from Missouri. Studs Terkel is right. Race is our American obsession. Since those first Africans and Spaniards landed on the Carolina shore in 1526, our society has repeatedly been torn apart and sometimes bound together by this issue of black-white relations. Over the years, white America has told itself varying stories about the enslavement of blacks. In each of the last two centuries, America's most popular novel was set in slavery. Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe and Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. The two books tell very different stories. Uncle Tom's Cabin presents slavery as an evil to be opposed, while Gone with the Wind suggests that slavery was an ideal social structure whose passing is to be lamented. Until the Civil Rights Movement, American history textbooks in this century pretty much agreed with Mitchell. In 1959, my high school textbook presented slavery as not such a bad thing. If bondage was a burden for African Americans, well, slaves were a burden on Old Massa and Old Miss, too. Besides, slaves were reasonably happy and well-fed. Such arguments constitute the Magnolia myth, according to which slavery was a social structure of harmony and grace that did no real harm to anyone, white or black. A famous 1950 textbook by Samuel Eliot Morrison and Henry Steele Commager actually said, "As for Sambo, whose wrongs moved the abolitionists to wrath and tears, there is some reason to believe that he suffered less than any other class in the South from its peculiar institution." Peculiar institution meant slavery, of course, and Morrison and Commager here provided a picture of it that came straight from Gone with the Wind. This is not what textbooks say today. Since the Civil Rights Movement, textbooks have returned part of the way toward Stowe's devastating indictment of the institution. The discussion in American History begins with a passage that describes the living conditions of slaves in positive terms. They were usually given adequate food, clothing, and shelter. But the author immediately goes on to point out, slaves had absolutely no rights. It was not simply that they could not vote or own property. Their owners had complete control over their lives. He concludes, slavery was almost literally inhuman. American Adventures tells us, slavery led to despair, and despair sometimes led black people to take their own lives. Or in some cases, it led them to revolt against white slaveholders. Life and Liberty takes a flatter view. Historians do not agree on how severely slaves were treated. The book goes on to note that whipping was common in some places, unheard of on other plantations. Life and Liberty ends its section on slave life, however, by quoting the titles of spirituals. "All my trials, Lord, soon be over." And by citing the inhumane details of slave laws. No one could read any of these three books and think well of slavery. Indeed, 10 of the 12 books I studied portray slavery as intolerable to the slave. Today's textbooks also show how slavery increasingly dominated our political life in the first half of the 19th century. They tell that the cotton gin made slavery more profitable. They tell how, in the 1830s, southern states and the federal government pushed the Indians out of vast stretches of Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, and slavery expanded. And they tell that, in the decades between 1830 and 1860, slavery's ideological demands grew shriller, more overtly racist. No longer was it enough for planters and slave traders to apologize for slavery as a necessary evil. Now slavery came to be seen of positive value to the slaves themselves, in the words of Triumph of the American Nation. This ideological extremism was matched by harsher new laws and customs. Talk of freeing the slaves became more and more dangerous in the South, in the words of the United States, A History of the Republic. Merely to receive literature advocating abolition became a felony in some slaveholding states. Southern states passed new ordinances interfering with the rights of masters to free their slaves. The legal position of already freed African Americans became ever more precarious, even in the North, as white Southerners prevailed on the federal government to make it harder to restrict slavery anywhere in the nation. Meanwhile, many Northern whites, as well as some who lived below the Mason-Dixon line, grew increasingly unhappy, disgusted that their nation had lost its idealism. The debate over slavery loomed ever larger, touching every subject. In 1848, Thomas Hart Benton, a senator from Missouri, likened the ubiquity of the issue to a biblical plague. "You could not look upon the table, but there were frogs. You could not sit down at the banquet table, but there were frogs. You could not go to the bridal couch and lift the sheets, but there were frogs. We can see nothing, touch nothing, have no measures proposed, without having this pestilence thrust before us." History textbooks now admit that slavery was the primary cause of the Civil War. In the words of The United States, A History of the Republic, "At the center of the conflict was slavery, the issue that would not go away." Before the Civil Rights Movement, many textbooks held that almost anything else, differences over tariffs and internal improvements, blundering politicians, the conflict between agrarian South and the industrial North caused the war. This was a form of Southern apologetics. Among the 12 textbooks I reviewed, only Triumph of the American Nation, a book that originated in the 1950s, still holds such a position. Why do textbooks now handle slavery with depth and understanding? Before the 1960s, publishers had been in thrall to the white South. In the 1920s, Florida and other Southern states passed laws requiring securing a correct history of the United States, including a true and correct history of the Confederacy. Textbooks were even required to call the Civil War the War Between the States, as if no single nation had existed which the South had rent apart. In the 15 years between 1955 and 1970, however, the Civil Rights Movement destroyed segregation as a formal system in America. The movement didn't succeed in transforming American race relations, but it did help African Americans win more power on the local level and prompted whites to abandon segregation. Today, many school boards, curricular committees, and high school history departments include African Americans or white Americans who have cast off the ideology of white supremacy. Therefore, contemporary textbooks can devote more space to the topic of slavery and can use that space to give a more accurate portrayal. Americans seem perpetually startled at slavery. Children are shocked to learn that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. Interpreters at Colonial Williamsburg say that many visitors are surprised to learn that slavery existed there, in the heart of plantation Virginia. Very few adults today realize that our society has been slave much longer than it has been free. Even fewer know that slavery was important in the North, too, until after the Revolutionary War. The first colony to legalize slavery was not Virginia, but Massachusetts. In 1720, of New York City's population of 7,000, 1,600 were African Americans, most of them slaves. Wall Street was the marketplace where owners could hire out their slaves by the day or week. Most textbooks downplay slavery in the North, however, so slavery seems to be a sectional rather than national problem. Indeed, even the expanded coverage of slavery comes across as an unfortunate but minor blemish compared to the overall storyline of our textbooks. James Oliver Horton has pointed out that the black experience cannot be fully illuminated without bringing a new perspective to the study of American history. Textbook authors have failed to present any new perspective. Instead, they shoehorn their improved and more accurate portrait of slavery into the old progress-as-usual storyline. In this saga, the United States is always intrinsically and increasingly democratic, and slaveholding is merely a temporary aberration, not part of the big picture. Ironically, the very success of the civil rights movement allows authors to imply that the problem of black-white race relations has now been solved, at least formally. This enables textbooks to discuss slavery without departing from their customary optimistic tone. While textbooks now show the horror of slavery and its impact on black America, they remain largely silent regarding the impact of slavery on white America, North or South. Textbooks have trouble acknowledging that anything might be wrong with white Americans, or with the United States as a whole. Perhaps telling realistically what slavery was like for slaves is the easy part. After all, slavery as an institution is dead. We have progressed beyond it, so we can acknowledge its evils. Even the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond has mounted an exhibit on slavery that does not romanticize the institution. Without explaining its relevance to the present, however, extensive coverage of slavery is like extensive coverage of the Hawley-Smoot tariff. Just more facts for hapless 11th graders to memorize. Slavery's twin legacies to the present are the social and economic inferiority it conferred upon blacks and the cultural racism it instilled in whites. Both continue to haunt our society. Therefore, treating slavery's enduring legacy is necessarily controversial. Unlike slavery, racism is not over yet. To function adequately in civic life in our troubled times, students must learn what causes racism. Although it's a complicated historical issue, racism in the Western world stems primarily from two related historical processes: taking land from and destroying indigenous peoples and enslaving Africans to work that land. To teach this relationship, textbooks would have to show students the dynamic interplay between slavery as a socioeconomic system and racism as an idea system. Sociologists call these the social structure and superstructure. Slavery existed in many societies and periods before and after the African slave trade. Made possible by Europe's advantages in military and social technology, the slavery started by Europeans in the 15th century was different, because it became the enslavement of one race by another. Increasingly, whites viewed the enslavement of whites as illegitimate, while the enslavement of Africans became acceptable. Unlike earlier slaveries, children of African-American slaves would be slaves forever, and could never achieve freedom through intermarriage with the owning class. The rationale for this differential treatment was racism. As Montesquieu, the French social philosopher who had such a profound influence on American democracy, ironically observed in 1748, "It is impossible for us to suppose these creatures to be men, because, allowing them to be men, a suspicion would follow that we ourselves are not Christian." Historians have chronicled the rise of racism in the West. Before the 1450s, Europeans considered Africans exotic, but not necessarily inferior. As more and more nations joined the slave trade, Europeans came to characterize Africans as stupid, backward, and uncivilized. Amnesia set in. Europe gradually found it convenient to forget that Moors from Africa had brought to Spain and Italy much of the learning that led to the Renaissance. Europeans had known that Timbuktu, with its renowned university and library, was a center for learning. Now, forgetting Timbuktu, Europe and European Americans perceived Africa as the dark continent. By the 1850s, many white Americans, including some Northerners, claimed that black people were so hopelessly inferior that slavery was a proper form of education for them. It also removed them physically from the alleged barbarism of the dark continent. The superstructure of racism has long outlived the social structure of slavery that generated it. The following passage from Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, written in the 1930s, shows racism alive and well in that decade. The narrator is interpreting Reconstruction. The former field hands found themselves suddenly elevated to the seats of the mighty. There they conducted themselves as creatures of small intelligence might naturally be expected to do. Like monkeys or small children turned loose among treasured objects whose value is beyond their comprehension, they ran wild, either from perverse pleasure in destruction or simply because of their ignorance. White supremacy permeates Mitchell's romantic bestseller. Yet in 1988, when the American Library Association asked library patrons to name the best book in the library, Gone with the Wind won an actual majority against all other books ever published. The very essence of what we have inherited from slavery is the idea that it is appropriate, even natural, for whites to be on top, blacks on the bottom. In its core, our culture tells us, tells all of us, including African Americans, that Europe's domination of the world came about because Europeans were smarter. In their core, many whites and some people of color believe this. White supremacy is not only a residue of slavery, to be sure. Developments in American history since slavery ended have maintained it. Textbooks that don't discuss white involvement in slavery in the period before 1863, however, are not likely to analyze white racism as a factor in more recent years. Only 5 of the 12 textbooks list racism, racial prejudice, or any term beginning with race in their indexes. Only 2 textbooks discuss what might have caused racism. The closest any of the textbooks comes to explaining the connection between slavery and racism is this single sentence from The American Tradition. In defense of their peculiar institution, Southerners became more and more determined to maintain their own way of life. Such a statement hardly suffices to show today's students the origin of racism in our society. It doesn't even use the word. The American Adventure offers a longer treatment. African Americans looked different from members of white ethnic groups. The color of their skin made assimilation difficult. For this reason, they remained outsiders. Here, adventure has retreated from history to lay psychology. Unfortunately for its argument, skin color in itself does not explain racism. Jane Elliott's famous experiment in Iowa classrooms have shown that children can quickly develop discriminatory behavior and prejudiced beliefs based on eye color. Conversely, the leadership positions that African Americans frequently reached among American Indian nations, from Ecuador to the Arctic, show that people don't automatically discriminate against others on the basis of skin color. Events and processes in American history, from the time of slavery to the present, are what explain racism. Not one textbook connects history and racism, however. Half-formed and uninformed notions rush in to fill the analytic vacuum textbooks thus leave. Adventure's 3 sentences imply that it is natural to exclude people whose skin color is different. White students may conclude that all societies are racist, perhaps by nature, so racism is all right. Black students may conclude that all whites are racist, perhaps by nature, so to be anti-white is all right. The elementary thinking in Adventure's 3 sentences is all too apparent. Yet this is the most substantial treatment of the causes of racism among all 12 textbooks. In omitting racism or treating it so poorly, history textbooks shirk a critical responsibility. Not all whites are or have been racist. Levels of racism have changed over time. If textbooks were to explain this, they would give students some perspective on what caused racism in the past, what perpetuates it today, and how it might be reduced in the future. Although textbook authors no longer sugarcoat how slavery affected African Americans, they minimize white complicity in it. They present slavery virtually as uncaused, a tragedy, rather than a wrong perpetrated by some people on others. Textbooks maintain the fiction that planters did the work on the plantations. There was always much work to be done, according to Triumph of the American Nation, for a cotton grower also raised most of the food eaten by his family and slaves. Although managing a business worth hundreds of thousands of dollars was surely time-consuming, the truth as to who did most of the work on the plantation is surely captured more accurately by this quotation from a Mississippi planter lamenting his situation after the war. "I never did a day's work in my life, and don't know how to begin. You see me in these coarse old clothes? Well, I never wore coarse clothes in my life before the war." The emotion generated by textbook descriptions of slavery is sadness, not anger. For there's no one to be angry at. Somehow we ended up with 4 million slaves in America, but no owners. This is part of a pattern in our textbooks. Anything bad in American history happened anonymously. Everyone named in our history made a positive contribution, except John Brown, as the next chapter shows. Or, as Frances Fitzgerald put it when she analyzed textbooks in 1979, "In all history, there is no known case of anyone's creating a problem for anyone else." Certainly the Founding Fathers never created one. Popular modern depictions of Washington and Jefferson are utterly at variance with their lives as 18th-century slave-holding planters. Textbooks play their part by minimizing slavery in the lives of the founders. As with Woodrow Wilson, Helen Keller, and Christopher Columbus, authors cannot bear to reveal anything bad about our heroes. Nevertheless, almost half of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were slave owners. In real life, the Founding Fathers and their wives wrestled with slavery. Textbooks canonize Patrick Henry for his "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. Not one tells us that 8 months after delivering the speech, he ordered diligent patrols to keep Virginia slaves from accepting the British offer of freedom to those who would join their side. Henry wrestled with the contradiction, exclaiming, "Would anyone believe that I am master of slaves of my own purchase?" Almost no one would today, because only 2 of the 12 textbooks, Land of Promise and The American Adventure, even mention the inconsistency. Henry's understanding of the discrepancy between his words and his deeds never led him to act differently, to his slaves' sorrow. Throughout the Revolutionary period, he added slaves to his holdings, and even at his death, unlike some other Virginia planters, he freed not one. Nevertheless, Triumph of the American Nation quotes Henry calling slavery as repugnant to humanity as it is inconsistent with the Bible and destructive of liberty, without ever mentioning that he held slaves. American Adventures devotes 3 whole pages to Henry, constructing a fictitious melodrama in which his father worries, "How would he ever earn a living?" Adventures then tells how Henry failed at storekeeping, tried to make a living by raising tobacco, started another store, had 3 children as well as a wife to support, knew he had to make a living in some way, so he decided to become a lawyer. The student who reads this chapter and later learns that Henry grew wealthy from the work of scores of slaves has a right to feel hoodwinked. Even more embarrassing is the case of Founding Father Thomas Jefferson. American history textbooks use several tactics to harmonize the contradiction between Jefferson's assertion that everyone has an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and his enslavement of 175 human beings at the time he wrote those words. Jefferson's slave holding affected almost everything he did, from his opposition to internal improvements to his foreign policy. Nonetheless, half of our textbooks never note that Jefferson owned slaves. Life and Liberty offers a half-page mini-biography of Jefferson, revealing that he was shy, stammered, and always worked hard at what he did. Elsewhere, Life contrasts Jefferson's political beliefs with Alexander Hamilton's and supplies 6 paragraphs about Jeffersonian changes of Federalist policies, noting that Jefferson refused to wear a wig, repealed a whiskey tax, and walked rather than rode in his inaugural parade. Life and Liberty says nothing about Jefferson and slavery, however. American history offers 6 different illustrations of the man for us to admire, but makes no mention of his slaveholding. The Challenge of Freedom mentions Jefferson on 16 different pages, but never in the context of slavery. Even textbooks that admit that Jefferson owned slaves go out of their way to downplay the fact. The American Way buries his complicity with the institution in a paragraph about his opposition to the practice. In his Notes on the State of Virginia, published in 1787, Thomas Jefferson spoke out against owning slaves. Slavery, he said, made tyrants out of the masters and destroyed the spirit of the slaves. Although Jefferson and others who owned slaves spoke against slavery, many people did not believe that a mixed society of equals could work. Jefferson and others who owned slaves is ambiguous. Only the careful reader will infer that Jefferson was a slave owner. Also ambiguous is Notes on the State of Virginia, which contains lengthy arguments about why blacks and whites can never participate in society equally. The attempt will probably never end but in the extermination of one or the other race, Jefferson luridly concluded. Way has mischaracterized the source. The paragraph in American Adventures is more forthright. The idea of slavery bothered Thomas Jefferson all his life. As an adult, he himself owned many slaves. He depended on their labor for raising tobacco on his plantation. Yet he understood that slavery was wrong, terribly wrong. It was the opposite of the thing he valued most in life, freedom. Again, the thrust of the treatment, the thing most likely to be remembered, is that Jefferson was an opponent of slavery, not a slave owner. Textbooks stress that Jefferson was a humane master, privately tormented by slavery and opposed to its expansion, not the type to destroy families by selling slaves. In truth, by 1820, Jefferson had become an ardent advocate of the expansion of slavery to the Western territories, and he never let his ambivalence about slavery affect his private life. Jefferson was an average master who had his slaves whipped and sold into the Deep South as examples to induce other slaves to obey. By 1822, Jefferson owned 267 slaves. During his long life, of hundreds of different slaves he owned, he freed only 3, and 5 more at his death, all blood relatives of his. Another textbook tactic to minimize Jefferson's slaveholding is to admit it, but emphasize that others did know better. "Jefferson revealed himself as a man of his times," states Land of Promise. Well, what were those times? Certainly most white Americans in the 1770s were racist. Race relations were in flux, however, due to the Revolutionary War and to its underlying ideology about the rights of mankind that Jefferson, among others, did so much to spread. 5,000 black soldiers fought alongside whites in the Continental Army, with courage and skill, according to Triumph of the American Nation. In reality, of course, some fought with courage and skill, like some white recruits, and some failed to fire their guns and ran off, like some white recruits. But because these men fought in integrated units for the most part, and received equal pay, their existence in itself helped decrease white racism. Moreover, the American Revolution is one of those moments in our history when the power of ideas made a real difference. "In contending for the birthright of freedom," said a captain in the army, "we have learned to feel for the bondage of others." Abigail Adams wrote her husband in 1774 to ask how we could fight ourselves for what we are daily robbing and plundering from those who have as good a right to freedom as we have. The contradiction between his words and his slave owning embarrassed Patrick Henry, who offered only a lame excuse. I am drawn along by the general inconvenience of living here without them," he admitted. "I will not, I cannot justify it." Other options were available to planters. Some, including George Washington, valued consistency more than Henry or Jefferson and freed their slaves outright, or at least in their wills. Other slave owners freed their male slaves to fight in the colonial army, collecting a bounty for each one who enlisted. In the first 2 decades after the Revolution, the number of free blacks in Virginia soared tenfold, from 2,000 in 1780 to 20,000 in 1800. Most northern states did away with slavery altogether. Thus, Thomas Jefferson lagged behind many whites of his times in the actions he took with regard to slavery. Manumission gradually flagged, however, because most of the white Southerners who, like Jefferson, kept their slaves, grew rich. Their neighbors thought well of them, as people often do, of those richer than themselves. To a degree, the ideology of the upper class became the ideology of the whole society, and as the Revolution receded, that ideology increasingly justified slavery. Jefferson himself spent much of his slave-earned wealth on his mansion at Monticello and on books that he later donated to the University of Virginia. These expenditures became part of his hallowed patrimony, giving history yet another reason to remember him kindly. Other views are possible, however. In 1829, 3 years after Jefferson's death, David Walker, a black Bostonian, warned members of his race that they should remember Jefferson as their greatest enemy. "Mr. Jefferson's remarks respecting us have sunk deep into the hearts of millions of whites and never will be removed this side of eternity." For the next 100 years, the open white supremacy of the Democratic Party, Jefferson's political legacy to the nation, would bear out the truth of Walker's warning. Textbooks are in good company. The Jefferson Memorial, too, whitewashes its subject. On its marble walls, a carved panel proclaims Jefferson's boast, "I have sworn eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of men," without ever mentioning his participation in racial slavery. Perhaps asking a marble memorial to tell the truth is demanding too much. Should history textbooks similarly be a shrine, however? Should they encourage students to worship Jefferson? Or should they help students understand him, wrestle with the problems he wrestled with, grasp his accomplishments, and also acknowledge his failures? The idealistic spark in our revolution, which caused Patrick Henry such verbal discomfort, at first made the United States a proponent of democracy around the world. However, slavery and its concomitant ideas, which legitimated hierarchy and dominance, sapped our revolutionary idealism. Most textbooks never hint at this clash of ideas, let alone at its impact on our foreign policy. After the Revolution, many Americans expected our example would inspire other peoples. It did. Our young nation got its first chance to help in the 1790s, when Haiti revolted against France. Whether a president owned slaves seems to have determined his policy toward the second independent nation in the hemisphere. George Washington did, so his administration loaned hundreds of thousands of dollars to the French planters in Haiti to help them suppress their slaves. John Adams did not, and his administration gave considerable support to the Haitians. Jefferson's presidency marked a general retreat from the idealism of the Revolution. Like other slave owners, Jefferson preferred a Napoleonic colony to a black republic in the Caribbean. In 1801, he reversed U.S. policy toward Haiti and secretly gave France the go-ahead to reconquer the island. In doing so, the United States not only betrayed its heritage, but also acted against its own self-interest. For if France had indeed been able to retake Haiti, Napoleon would have maintained his dream of an American empire. The United States would have been hemmed in by France to its west, Britain to its north, and Spain to its south. But planters in the United States were scared by the Haitian Revolution. They thought it might inspire slave revolts here, which it did. When Haiti won, despite our flip-flop, the United States would not even extend it diplomatic recognition, lest its ambassador inflame our slaves by exhibiting in his own person an example of successful revolt, in the words of a Georgia senator. 5 of the 12 textbooks mention how Haitian resistance led France to sell us its claim to Louisiana, but none tells of our flip-flop. Indeed, no textbook ever makes any connection between slavery and U.S. foreign policy. Racial slavery also affected our policy toward the next countries in the Americas to revolt. Spain's colonies. Haiti's example inspired them to seek independence, and the Haitian government gave Simon Bolivar direct aid. Our statesmen were ambivalent, eager to help boot a European power out of the hemisphere, but worried by the racially mixed rebels doing the booting. Some planters wanted our government to replace Spain as the colonial power, especially in Cuba. Jefferson suggested annexing Cuba. 50 years later, diplomats in the Franklin Pierce administration signed the Austin Manifesto, which proposed that the United States buy or take the island from Spain. Slave owners, still obsessed with Haiti as a role model, thus hoped to prevent Cuba's becoming a second Haiti, with flames that might extend to our own neighboring shores, in the words of the manifesto. In short, slavery prompted the United States to have imperialist designs on Latin America rather than visions of democratic liberation for the region. Slavery affected our foreign policy in still other ways. The first requirement of a slave society is secure borders. We don't like to think of the United States as a police state, a nation like East Germany that people had to escape from, but the slave-holding states were just that. Indeed, after the Dred Scott decision in 1857, which declared a Negro had no rights a white man was bound to respect, thousands of free African Americans realized they could not be safe, even in northern states, and fled to Canada, Mexico, and Haiti. Slaveholders dominated our foreign policy until the Civil War. They were always concerned about our Indian borders and made sure that treaties with native nations stipulated that Indians surrender all African Americans and return any runaways. U.S. territorial expansion between 1787 and 1855 was due in large part to slavers' influence. The largest pressure group behind the War of 1812 was slaveholders who coveted Indian and Spanish land and wanted to drive Indian societies farther away from the slave-holding states to prevent slave escapes. Even though Spain played no real role in that war, in the aftermath, we took Florida from Spain because slaveholders demanded we do so. Indeed, Andrew Jackson attacked a Seminole fort in Florida in 1816 precisely because it harbored hundreds of runaway slaves, thus initiating the First Seminole War. The Seminoles didn't exist as a tribe or nation before the arrival of Europeans and Africans. They were a tri-racial isolate composed of Creek Indians, remnants of smaller tribes, runaway slaves, and whites who preferred to live in Indian society. The word Seminole is itself a corruption of the Spanish, Cimarron, corrupted to Maroons on Jamaica, a word that came to mean runaway slaves. The Seminoles' refusal to surrender their African-American members led to the First and Second Seminole Wars, 1816 to 1818, 1835 to 1842. Whites attacked not because they wanted the Everglades, which had no economic value to the United States in the 19th century, but to eliminate a refuge for runaway slaves. The Second Seminole War was the longest and costliest war the United States ever fought against Indians. The college textbook, America, Past and Present, tells why we fought it, putting the war in the context of slave revolts. The most sustained and successful effort of slaves to win their freedom by force of arms took place in Florida between 1835 and 1842, when hundreds of black fugitives fought in the Second Seminole War alongside the Indians who had given them a haven. The Seminoles were resisting removal to Oklahoma, but for the blacks who took part, the war was a struggle for their own freedom, and the treaty that ended it allowed most of them to accompany their Indian allies to the Trans-Mississippi West. This is apparently too radical for high school. Only 6 of the 12 textbooks even mention the war. Of these, only 4 say that ex-slaves fought with the Seminoles. Not one tells that the ex-slaves were the real reason for that war. Slavery was also perhaps the key factor in the Texas War, 1835 to 1836, the freedom for which Davy Crockett, James Bowie, and the rest fought at the Alamo was the freedom to own slaves. As soon as Anglos set up the Republic of Texas, its legislature ordered all free black people out of the Republic. Our next war, the Mexican War, 1846 to 1848, was again driven chiefly by Southern planters wanting to push the borders of the nearest free land farther from the slave states. Probably the clearest index of how slavery affected U.S. foreign policy is provided by the Civil War. For between 1861 and 1865, we had 2 foreign policies, the Union's and the Confederacy's. The Union recognized Haiti and shared considerable ideological compatibility with post-revolutionary Mexico. The Confederacy threatened to invade Mexico, and then welcomed Louis Napoleon's takeover of it as a French colony, because that removed Mexico as a standard-bearer of freedom and a refuge for runaway slaves. Confederate diplomats also had their eyes on Cuba, had they won the Civil War. For our first 70 years as a nation, then, slavery made our foreign policy more sympathetic with imperialism than with self-determination. Textbooks can't show the influence of slavery on our foreign policy if they are unwilling to talk about ideas like racism that might make whites look bad. When textbook authors turn their attention to domestic policy, racism remains similarly invisible. Thus, although textbooks devote a great deal of attention to Stephen A. Douglas, the most important leader of the Democratic Party at mid-century, they suppress his racism. Recall that Douglas had bulldozed what came to be called the Kansas-Nebraska Act through Congress in 1854. Douglas himself, a senator from Illinois and seeker of the presidency, was neither for nor against slavery. He mainly wanted the United States to organize territorial governments in Kansas and Nebraska, until then Indian land, because he was connected with interests that wanted to run a railroad through the territory. He needed Southern votes. During most of the 1840s and 1850s, Southern planters controlled the Supreme Court, the presidency, and at least one House of Congress. Emboldened by their power while worried about their decreasing share of the nation's white population, slave owners agreed to support the new territories only if Douglas included in the bill a clause opening them to slavery. Douglas capitulated and incorporated what he called popular sovereignty in the bill. This meant that Kansas could go slave if it chose to, even though it lay north of the Missouri Compromise Line, set up in 1820 to separate slavery from freedom. So, for that matter, could Nebraska. The result was civil war in Kansas. While textbooks don't treat Stephen Douglas as a major hero like Christopher Columbus or Woodrow Wilson, they do discuss him with sympathy. In 1858, Douglas ran for re-election against Abraham Lincoln, in a contest that presaged the ideologies that would dominate the 2 major parties for the next 3 decades. Accordingly, textbooks give the debates an extraordinary amount of space, an average of 7 paragraphs and 2 pictures. Textbook authors use this space as if they were writing for Vanity Fair. American History gives the debates 16 paragraphs. Here are two of them. Even without his tall stovepipe hat, the 6 feet 6 inch, the author has added 2 inches, Lincoln towered over the little giant. He wore a formal black suit, usually rumpled and always too short for his long arms and legs. Douglas was what we would call a flashy dresser. He wore shirts with ruffles, fancy embroidered vests, a broad felt hat. He had a rapid-fire way of speaking that contrasted with Lincoln's slow, deliberate style. Lincoln's voice was high-pitched, Douglas's deep. Both had to have powerful lungs to make themselves heard over the street noises and the bustle of the crowds. They had no public address systems to help them. The author of The American Way concentrates in a similar fashion on appearances and voices. One member of the audience, Gustav Korner, reported how each of the candidates looked and what effect each had on his audience. Douglas was fighting for his political life. No greater contrast could be imagined than the one between Lincoln and Douglas. The latter was really a little giant physically, while Lincoln, when standing erect, towered to 6 feet 4 inches. Lincoln, awkward in posture and leaning a little forward, stood calm. He addressed his hearers in a somewhat familiar yet very earnest way, with a clear, distinct, and far-reaching voice, generally well-controlled, but sometimes expressive of sadness, though at times he could assume a most humorous and even comical look. So we learn that Douglas was a flashy dresser and spoke powerfully. But where are his ideas? What did he say? Although Way quotes 9 sentences of the bystander's description, all 12 textbooks combined give just 3-sentence fragments from Douglas himself. Here is every word of his they provide. "Forever divided into free and slave states as our fathers made it, thinks the Negro is his brother," and "for a day or an hour." Just 24 words in 12 books. While celebrating the little giant for his powerful speech or splendid oratory, 9 textbooks silence him completely. Instead, the omnipresent authorial voice supplies his side of the debates. Douglas was for popular sovereignty. This summary from Life and Liberty is shorter than most, but otherwise representative. Of course, phrased this abstractly, who would oppose popular sovereignty? Douglas's position was not so vague, however. The debate was largely about the morality of racially based slavery, and the position African Americans should eventually hold in our society. That is why Paul Engle chose the title, Created Equal, for his centennial edition of the debates. On July 9, 1858 in Chicago, Douglas made his position clear, as he did repeatedly throughout that summer. "In my opinion, this government of ours is founded on the white basis. It was made by the white man, for the benefit of the white man, to be administered by white men. I am opposed to taking any step that recognizes the Negro man or the Indian as the equal of the white man. I am opposed to giving him a voice in the administration of the government. I would extend to the Negro and the Indian, and to all dependent races, every right, every privilege, and every immunity consistent with the safety and welfare of the white races. But equality they never should have, either political or social, or in any other respect whatever. My friends, you see that the issues are distinctly drawn." Textbook readers cannot see that the issues are distinctly drawn, however, because textbooks give them no access to Douglas's side. American History is the only textbook that quotes Stephen Douglas on race. "Lincoln thinks the Negro is his brother," the little giant sneered. Why do textbooks censor Douglas? Since they devote paragraphs to his wardrobe, it can't be for lack of space. To be sure, textbook authors rarely quote anyone. but more particularly, the heroification process seems to be operating again. Douglas's words might make us think badly of him. Compared to Douglas, Lincoln was an idealistic equalitarian, but in southern Illinois, arguing with Douglas, he too expressed white supremacist ideas. Thus, at the debate in Charleston, he said, "I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about the social and political equality of the white and black races." Applause. "That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes." Textbook authors protect us from a racist Lincoln. By doing so, they diminish students' capacity to recognize racism as a force in American life. For if Lincoln could be a racist, then so might the rest of us be. And if Lincoln could transcend racism, as he did on occasion, then so might the rest of us. During the Civil War, Northern Democrats countered the Republican charge that they favored rebellion by professing to be the white man's party. They protested the government's emancipation of slaves in the District of Columbia and its diplomatic recognition of Haiti. They claimed Republicans had nothing except nigger on the brain. They were enraged when the U.S. Army accepted African-American recruits, and they made race a paramount factor in their campaigns. In those days before television, parties held coordinated rallies. On the last Saturday before the election, Democratic senators might address crowds in each major city. Local office holders would hold forth in smaller towns. Each of these rallies featured music. Hundreds of thousands of songbooks were printed so the party faithful might sing the same songs coast to coast. A favorite, in 1864, was sung to the tune of Yankee Doodle Dandy. The New National Anthem. Nigger Doodle Dandy. Yankee Doodle is no more, sunk his name and station. Nigger Doodle takes his place and favors amalgamation. Chorus. Nigger Doodle's all the go, ebony shins and bandy. Loyal people all must bow to Nigger Doodle Dandy. The white breed is under par, it lacks the rich aromy. Give us something black as tar, give us old Dahomey. Chorus. Nigger Doodle's all the go, ebony shins and bandy. Loyal people all must bow to Nigger Doodle Dandy. Blubber lips are killing sweet, and kinky heads are splendid. And oh, it makes such bully feet to have the heels extended. Chorus. Nigger Doodle's all the go, ebony shins and bandy. Loyal people all must bow to Nigger Doodle Dandy. I've shared these lyrics with hundreds of college students and scores of high school history teachers. To get audiences to take the words seriously, I usually try to lead them in a sing-along. Often even all white groups refuse. They're shocked by what they read. Nothing in their high school history textbooks hinted that national politics was ever like this. Partly because many party members and leaders didn't identify with the war effort, when the Union won, Democrats emerged as the minority party. Republicans controlled Reconstruction. Like slavery, Reconstruction is a subject on which textbooks have improved since the Civil Rights Movement. The earliest accounts written even before Reconstruction ended portrayed Republican state governments struggling to govern fairly, but confronted with immense problems, not the least being violent resistance from racist ex-Confederates. Textbooks written between about 1890 and the 1960s, however, painted an unappealing portrait of oppressive Republican rule in the post-war period, a picture that we might call the Confederate myth of Reconstruction. For years, black families kept the truth about Reconstruction alive. The aging slaves, whose stories were recorded by WPA writers in the 1930s, remained proud of blacks' roles during Reconstruction. Some still remembered the names of African Americans elected to office 60 years earlier. I know folks think the books tell the truth, said an 80-year-old former slave, but they sure don't. As those who knew Reconstruction from personal experience died off, however, even in the